So tonight we're going to be studying some material that might be interesting to some of you, as if I can make it interesting. You realize a lot of times when you're listening to teachings from Jewish Roots teachers or Messianic sources, or maybe reading something on Chabad, or you know, or maybe you're in the Stone Edition Chumash and you see teachers being cited. A lot of them have unusual names like Rashi, Ibn Ezra, Rambam, Radak, Ramban, Rashbam, these sorts of things. So I'm going to introduce you to some of these guys. We're actually moving out of what we could call the classical period, which was the Mishnah, the Talmud, the Gemara, thank you, Gemara, the Midrash, and the forming of the Siddur, the liturgical service. This is what we've studied so far. So we're leaving those things behind in the classical period, even though we should have talked about Targums, but we didn't. But we're leaving them behind in the classical period. And we're moving into the Middle Ages. The Middle Ages, we'll call this the Age of Commentators. People writing commentaries on the aforementioned, on the Torah, on the Bible, and the aforementioned sources. We have some brilliant minds, some bright, shining examples that stick out and are considered by the Jewish community today to be essentials. That if you're going to study Torah, these are the essential guys. So I picked out a couple of them that are pretty common and thought we would just learn about them. We'll start with Rashi. Okay, so Rashi, this is Rashi right here. I've got my Rashi books right here. This is just Rashi on the Torah. Actually, Rashi wrote a commentary on the Talmud, and he wrote a commentary on the whole Bible, well, the whole Tanakh, right? But here we have Rashi on the five books of the Torah. When I first started studying with Chabad, they'd say it's better not to read Torah than it's preferable to not to even read Torah than to read Torah without the Rashi. It gives you an idea of how important Rashi is to Judaism and under. Okay, so why is Rashi so important? Well, here's this French rabbi. He used to make wine. He was a vintner who made wine. That's the rumor, anyway. He lived in the days of great persecution against the Jewish community. The Crusades were underway, and this was a period of time when the church would come in with armed men in the middle of a synagogue service on a Saturday. They would close up the doors, and then a bishop would get up and address the congregation and teach them the gospel and tell them why they needed to convert and become Christians. That was the sort of polemic that set the tone of the period between these two religions. Then there was as the Crusades began, they would lock the doors of the synagogue and burn everybody inside alive. As the Crusaders moved through the regions, they killed Jews as they went, and this is well known. So Rashi lived in this period of time, and he saw this sort of thing going on. So the polemic, the argument with Christianity certainly colors his work in his interpretations. People often point that out. He saw all of the places he studied in Mainz and in Worms, all of the teachers he studied under died in a popular uprising against the Jewish community called the People's Crusade. And, you know, these things were endorsed by the church. At that time, you could actually, I've never done the research on this, but popular legend says that you could get an indulgence for violence against the Jewish community at the time. So you get an idea of the tensions that existed at this time. So here's Rashi. He's a brilliant, brilliant scholar, a brilliant rabbi, and he... he creates these commentaries. He's writing these commentaries. His goal at the outset You know, because there's a lot of, first of all, there's a lot of allegorical interpretations of the scriptures going around. A lot of allegorical interpretations, both in Judaism and also from this Christian polemic that was coming in all the time. So he states his goal in writing these commentaries, especially his commentaries on the Bible, is that he doesn't want to go into the remez, the drash, and the sod that we learned about when we were learning midrash, but rather he wants to stay in the peshat, which is the literal. Only the literal face value meaning of the scriptures is what he wants to teach. And he says, his famous statement is, I am only explaining the Torah on the level that a five-year-old would comprehend it, would understand it. All right. So we have yet to find this five-year-old. Right? Because in fact, Rashi's commentaries are really, let me put it this way, there are over 300 classic commentaries on Rashi's commentaries. These are super commentaries, commentaries about commentaries, you know, just people trying to unravel Rashi and figure out what made him comment on this or not comment on that, or why did he skip this or why did he choose that, this sort of thing, and from where did he get this and from where did he get that, because in reality he doesn't really stick with the Peshat, not what I would call the Peshat, because to me the Peshat would just be the literal reading of the scriptures, you know, but Rashi, in Rashi's Peshat includes everything that the sages said. So he takes all the Midrash and all the Gemara and all the Talmud, you know, and all of these things, and he'll use these to explain and to expand the text. And he'll often say in a Midrash, or you know, he'll make the distinction, but he brings all of this in. So a lot of times, people who are unfamiliar with Jewish literature, the classical Jewish literature, they just read the Rashi. So you hear a lot of Rashi says this, Rashi says that. But if you really look into it, Rashi is just quoting the Talmud when the Talmud says this or the Talmud says that. Anyway, so he writes his commentary on the, and he's brilliant. I mean, he's absolutely brilliant. He's a brilliant linguist, scholar. His mind works in amazing ways that, you know, the super commentaries are still trying to figure out. He's considered to be the father of Jewish commentaries because he kind of set the standard when he wrote these commentaries. And in fact, if you had I should have one in hand. If you have a Chumash, which is a Jewish published Bible or a Jewish published books of Moses, you'll always find that the Rashi is printed right along next to the text. So Rashi's explanations come right with it. And you'll notice that Rashi, when you're looking at the Rashi, if you know Hebrew at all, you'll notice that it's like a different Hebrew script. It's called Rashi script. And the thing is, you know, so you've got block Hebrew lettering, and then you hit the Rashi script, and you can tell now I'm not reading the text anymore, now I'm reading Rashi's commentary, because it changes fonts, so to speak, into sort of what you could consider a cursive, Hebrew cursive font. It's not the modern Hebrew cursive, but it's an older one. And this was introduced, interestingly enough, by a Christian who, in publishing Rashi's commentaries on the Torah, wanted to be able to distinguish between where the text of the Torah stopped and Rashi's comments began. Well, so that's where you get Rashi script. Same goes with the Talmud. He has his commentary on the Talmud is printed right, you know, right on the page there. You know, so you've got. I showed you a page of the Talmud. Here we have this page of the Talmud, and you've got commentaries surrounding it, right? So here's the center. The center column is the Mishnah and the Gemara. That's the real thing, And then these commentaries are surrounding it, and this is Rashi. I believe this one's Rashi, off to the side here. And then you've got later commentaries, Rashi's grandchildren, surrounding those. So, suffice to say, in Jewish studies, Rashi is a cornerstone. Why is he called Rashi? Well, his real name is Rabbi Shlomo Yitzhak. And this introduces that subject of acronyms. We use acronyms all the time to speak of rabbis. And so you can see Rashi, it's the R from Rabbi, the SH from Shlomo, and the I or the E sound from Yitzhak. Rashi. Got it? Rashi had three daughters. Legend says, Rashi's three daughters wore tefillin. Nobody knows this for sure. Sort of a scandal if they did. That's the legend. But I could, maybe the idea is just like Rashi was so desperate to have sons. Anyway, what's true is that two of his daughters went on to marry great scholars who themselves carried on Rashi's work and helped publish Rashi's work and actually finished up areas of commentary that he hadn't closed off. So, what else could I tell you about Rashi? Maybe we should read a little Rashi just so you get a flavor of it. How many of you studied Rashi with Aaron? Yeah, quite a few of you. So you kind of know what this is like anyway. What's our parsha this week? Vayigash? Right? We'll look at something random from Vayigash. Or is it Miketz? It's Miketz. What were we at last week? Yeah, Vayeshev, so it's Miketz. All right. Here's what Rashi sounds like on Parshat Miketz. The first verse of Parshat Miketz says, "It happened at the end of 2 years to the day Pharaoh was dreaming that, behold, he was standing over the canal." Okay, we'll just see what we have on that verse. Now, Rashi is very concise, extremely concise in his comments. It happened at the end, all right, which is Vayehi Miketz. It happened at the end. So, he says, in the Targum, or like the Targum, the word Miketz is to be understood, as the Targum renders it, Misof, at the end. All words related to Ketz mean end. Okay, so first thing is a grammatical point. We had a grammatical point on the name of the Parsha, Miketz. Over the canal. All other rivers are not called canals, because literally the Hebrew says al hayor, so it doesn't say over the river, it says over the canal. That he was, Pharaoh dreamt he was standing over, our Bibles probably say Pharaoh dreamt he was standing beside the river. Well, the Hebrew literally says over the river, but it literally says over the canal. So he says all other rivers are not called canals. Only the Nile is called canals, for all the land is made into many man-made canals, and the Nile goes up into them and waters them and fills them with water, because rains do not regularly fall in Egypt as they do in other lands. So he gives us a geographical point. That's great, isn't it? We're just working on two words, and we had a grammatical point and a geographical point. So you can see how Rashi is, he really is working in the Peshat here. He's saying, what is the literal meaning of the text? Okay, that's Rashi. Got any questions on Rashi? All right. How about this guy, Ibn Ezra? I really don't know anything about him, except that I see him referenced all the time, Ibn Ezra, right? So I looked him up, you know, Wikipedia. Ibn Ezra, Spanish rabbi, wrote a commentary on the Torah, wrote commentary on the on Isaiah, wrote commentary on the Minor Prophets. These commentaries are often cited. They appear in printed collections of on the scriptures. He was an expert in Hebrew grammar, like Rashi. He wrote several books of grammars on the language. He's also very much a scientist, interested in astronomy and Jewish astrology, which is not the same as normal astrology. It's similar. But Jewish astrology is you know, rooted in the Talmud and that sort of thing. And, you know, it's the kind of thing that Aaron Eby will be talking about at his Christmas special on December 15th. You know, magi following stars and so forth. Anyway, I think he might even have a quote from Ibn Ezra in that, if I recall from the presentation last year. So this is Ibn Ezra. He's just another important commentator. He lived around the same time as Rashi, a little bit later than Rashi. Next big name here, Rambam. Now, we're also going to learn Ramban tonight. So start getting used to the idea right now that Rambam is not Ramban, and Ramban is not Rambam. Can you hear the difference when I say that? Yeah. Okay. So what's the difference? Well, this one is Rabbi Moshe ben Maimon, and you take the R from Rabbi, the M from Moshe, and the M from, or the B from Ben, and the M from Maimon, you get Rambam. However, we also refer to him with the name Maimonides, which just means son of Maimon. Okay, so same guy, Maimonides and Rambam. Same guy. All right, so what's up with Rambam? Spanish fellow, just like Ibn Ezra. Sephardic Jew. And he grew up under Moorish culture. You know, the Moors controlled Spain at the time, and so he grew up speaking Arabic and having a lot of interface with the Muslim world. And this was the Muslim world at the height of what that we, you know, this is the golden age of Islam. Okay, and so it's an educated Muslim world. So Rambam grew up, you know, it is a Jewish community and everything, but he grew up interfacing with the Muslim world. And check this out, through Arabic and contact with the Muslim world, he studies Aristotle and Plato. You know, it's not kind of like when you think of like learning with Muslims, you don't think of like learning Greek philosophy. But he did, because this was a different Muslim world than we're familiar with. And so he became enamored by Greek philosophy and logic and science and what we could call rationalism and even a little bit of naturalism, a little bit. He really loved the idea presented in Plato and Aristotle about the unknowable God. Also presented in Gnosticism, but anyway, but how God is completely can't be fathomed, unknowable, unsearchable, can't have any intersection with the finite and so forth. And he liked this approach to God, and he worked to reconcile the philosophies he learned from the Greeks with Judaism. And this colors his work. So he's a rationalist. People really like Rambam because he's, you know, he's like, he's not going to easily accept a miraculous explanation or a mystical explanation. He's more of a, you know, real world guy, I guess you could call him. He's a man for our age. He made his living as a physician. Well, that's not quite how it happened. First, there was a conquest, and another Muslim group came in, and there was a conquest. He had to flee. He had to escape. He and the rest of the Jewish community, they had to pretend to convert to Islam. They had and then leave quickly. And so he headed out for. He went to the land of Israel for briefly, and then he went on to live in Egypt. And then he and his family said, well, what are we going to do here in Egypt? Let's try commerce. They put all their money together and he put it in the hands of his youngest brother. I just learned all this today on Wikipedia. Put it in the hands of his youngest brother. And this is amazing because this story about Maimonides was found in documents in the Cairo Geniza. Anyway, that's just pretty recent discovery. So they put the money in the hands of this kid. He's a young man. He has a wife. He has a child. And they send him off. This was Maimonides' little brother that he raised. And they send him off and to buy merchandise. He comes and he sends back a letter. Says, you know, I really think I could do better in India. I can get a better price in India. Rambam's like, don't go to India. He goes to India and this ship sinks on the way. Breaks Maimonides' heart. His heart is broken for his brother. He can't get out of bed for a year. So he has to raise his wife and his children. And anyway, so he has got to support himself somehow, so he becomes a physician. And this is his main thing. He becomes a physician. And he writes medical books. He writes textbooks. He's just brilliant. But he also dabbled in Torah on the side. And so as he's dabbling in Torah on the side, he decides, the Torah's a mess. I mean, you've got the Torah. Then you've got the Mishnah. Then you've got the Gemara. I mean, how is anybody supposed to sort through all this? It's more than one person. Like, if I want to know what is the rule, how do I know what to do? You know, I'm supposed to study all this. So he says, this needs to be codified, simplified. And so this is what he did. He set out to write a commentary on the Mishnah and then to codify the 613 commandments. I've got his, this is very brief. Look at that, 613 commandments in two volumes. Boom, right there. So he goes through the commandments, says, this is the commandment, this is the obligation. Works through the Mishnah along the same lines. Very logical, rational, brilliant mind. Has the whole scope of Jewish literature in his head somehow and is able to, you know, just put it together. And so he's the great codifier. This is how we should remember him. Maimonides, Rambam, the great codifier. In his commentary on the Mishnah, he lays out 13 principles that he considers to be essential to Judaism. This is the 13 principles of Jewish faith nowadays. So he basically wrote the creed of Judaism inadvertently as he was writing his commentary on the Mishnah. He gives us the principles that says this is how you'll know Messiah. So he gives us the laws of how to recognize Messiah when he comes. Great stuff. It's just I can't even begin to tell you how important Maimonides is, how important Rambam's works are. What else did he do? He wrote Guide for the Perplexed. This is what I was telling you about trying to reconcile Judaism and Greek philosophy. Anyway, so this is Rambam. Rambam was not well received. His writings were not well received in his day. In fact, everybody felt like this was completely out of order, codifying Jewish law. And they felt like, especially this, like trying to marry philosophical ideas with Judaism, this raised questions. And there are all sorts of reasons for objecting. People had objections. Mostly everyone's jealous, I think. Anyway, so Rambam was not well received in his lifetime by the Jewish community. And you know, a prophet's without honor in his home, right? All right, any questions on Rambam? Man, what else could I tell you about Rambam? I don't know. doesn't.
Did he group the 613 commandments, or was that just kind of previously?
No, you're right. Okay. That's a good question. That's a very good question. There was not a list prior to him. Everyone just talked about the 613 commandments, but there wasn't a comprehensive list. I believe he was the first to attempt to codify a list. And the way he did it, you know, he has several criteria for it. I won't get into it. Not everybody agreed with his criteria for how to put together the list. Ramban, who we'll learn about in a minute, put his own list together, for example. Because it's not clear. First of all, it's not clear where anybody got the number 613 from in the first place. That's a pretty arbitrary, you know, and it's not clear. It's like, you know, is the commandment of the burnt offering, for example, do you count the whole thing as one commandment, or is it a commandment to bring a bull to lay your hands on it? Is that two commandments to flay it? Is that three commandments to offer up? It's, you know, it's like, it's not clear by any stretch of how you would derive a commandment, or, you know, one or two or three. And a lot of times commandments are stated in a positive and a negative form. Is that two commandments? Anyway, so he devised a whole criteria, a whole mathematical, logical system for doing this, and gave us the list of 613 commandments. Okay, that's Rambam. Not really a big fan of Rambam myself, but he's, I don't know. I have tremendous respect for him, but I don't really agree with a lot of those rationalist conclusions. I'm more of an irrationalist. All right, Radak. This is one you don't hear as much, but I thought I'd throw him in here anyway, just for fun. I don't really know much about Radak. His real name is Rabbi David Kimchi. There you go. Here's why I'm interested in him, I guess. He's most famous for his commentaries on the prophets. So every time you're reading a commentary on the prophets, you're getting citations from Radak. You know, Radak says this, Radak says that. However, another area of work that he was very much involved with was disputations with Christians. And particularly over this area, where Christians would say, well, we are the new Israel. And they would interpret the prophecies in such a way to steer them away from the literal meaning of the reestablishment of the Jewish people in the land of Israel and so forth. And they said, no, we are the real, we're the new Israel. These have to be understood spiritually. So he gears a lot of his writings towards saying, no, this is about Israel. But more than that, then, if there is a messianic component to the prophecy, he tends to steer it away from anything that might feed the Christian interpretation. Same with Rashi. You know, these guys are involved in polemics. And so if you have two interpretations on the table in front of you of, say, Isaiah 53, okay, I'm just saying for sake of ease, Isaiah 53, there's two interpretations in classical Jewish literature of the suffering servant. On the one hand, it's the Messiah. On the other hand, it's the nation, right? So now if you're involved in a polemic with the Christian community and they're doing these awful things that I'm describing, you're not going to present the interpretation that will validate their claims. Instead, you just put that one under the table, right? And so that's what we see with a lot of these classic medieval commentaries, is a tendency to diminish a messianic interpretation, and certainly to steer away from a Christian interpretation. All right, so that's Radak. Good.
Where did he live?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't remember.